and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. After what was perhaps a better night's sleep last night, people in the US are digesting the results of this week's election and what was a remarkable political comeback by the now president-elect Donald Trump. He won't actually be sworn in until January. Nevertheless, the process of putting together his senior White House team, his cabinet and the wider administration begins now. He's expected to start announcing the names of those he's chosen for the top jobs, such as his chief of staff and secretary of state, very soon. And President Biden, for he remains president for another 2 months, has invited his successor to the White House to discuss the transition of power, a courtesy that Mr. Trump didn't extend to Joe Biden back in 2020. For Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party, the soul-searching into why they fared badly on Tuesday now begins. Last night, Ms. Harris spoke at her old college, Howard University, to concede the election.
The outcome of this election is not what we wanted, not what we fought for, not what we voted for. But hear me when I say, the light of America's promise will always burn bright.
The truth is that many people in the US aren't feeling that sense of promise, weighed down by the high cost of living, cited by so many voters as their main concern in the election. One of the first swing states to declare victory for Donald Trump was Georgia. The result was a major upset for the Democrats, who'd won that state 4 years ago from the Republicans. John Sudworth has been hearing the reactions of people in the city of Sparta.
Even without the rain, a gloom hangs over Sparta. It's the kind of place Donald Trump might have in mind when he speaks darkly of American decline, although Sparta's been struggling for decades. Well, over half of the shops on the high street here are boarded up. Katie Webster is trying to change things.
We are a coffee shop and we also sell pastries and some savory items.
Behind the counter at the new coffee and craft shop, she's not convinced by Mr. Trump's promises of economic renewal.
I'm a little scared, to be honest. It disheartens me that so many Americans chose someone who, by any measure, does not seem to be a very good human being.
In Georgia, however, the bedrock of Democratic Party support is not white voters like Katie, but black voters. And in Sparta, more than two-thirds of registered voters are black, helping Kamala Harris outperform Donald Trump here with more than 67% of the vote.
We're from BBC News in England.
Lord have mercy. Good God.
But Ms. Harris has not done quite as well as Joe Biden did in 2020. Exit polls suggest Mr. Trump has been winning over more black voters, not in huge numbers, but enough to make a difference and helping him to win the state as a whole.
There's a kind of nice coincidence in that first name, Donald.
Mm-hmm.
Did you vote for your namesake?
Yeah.
You voted for Mr. Trump?
Yeah. I don't know. I believe he's going to do a good job.
71-year-old Donald Curry was swayed by the former president's messages on immigration.
They come in here, they get the money, they send it back to their hometown. If the American people wake up and stop taking care of other countries, we need to take care of us and too much worry about the other country.
So his messages about tougher enforcement at the border, deporting immigrants, that's something you support?
Yeah, I feel like they need to be over there.
Send them home?
And send them home.
I'm a Baptist pastor. I just preach the Bible, whatever's in the Bible. We just try to get the word out for Jesus.
In Georgia, with its painful history of slavery and segregation, questions of race are never far from the surface.
Kind of generally in the South, you hear that the most segregated day of the week is Sunday.
Brian Hill is the pastor of Sparta's Baptist Church, an overwhelmingly white congregation.
Can I ask if you voted, and if so, how?
I did vote. I voted for Trump. I don't really care for Trump. I felt like, you know, I'm not voting for the pastor of the country. I'm voting for the president.
Later, outside Sparta's supermarket, I bump into Katie from the coffee shop again. She has something to add.
People in this county voted for Trump because they're racist. I just need you to know that. Don't want a woman president, and they're racist.
And yet an argument can be made that the Democrats' dismissal of their opponents in such terms and their inability to take seriously Donald Trump's appeal among voters they've long taken for granted is part of the reason they lost.
When you believe in God, there are some things that were being promoted that I just couldn't agree with. The abortion, the transgender thing, it's just not right.
Vanessa Fluellen works in law enforcement in Sparta at the local 911 hotline.
You're a black woman. This was a chance to vote for somebody who would have been America's first female black president. Did that not excite you?
Well, who said she was black?
To find black voters like Vanessa questioning Kamala Harris's race, just as Donald Trump has done, may seem extraordinary. But for Democrats, rather than repeated surprise at his success, understanding why he's making inroads in communities like this one may be the first step in fighting back.
The economy was a little better when Trump was in office last time. He gets things done.
Good to have a strong leader?
It's great to have a strong leader. You gotta have a strong leader.
Donald Trump's messages of economic decline resonate in places like Sparta, and it's a big part of why he's won.
John Sudworth reporting. So, will Donald Trump manage to help communities like Sparta in Georgia and the many others across the US feeling the pinch? A question I put to one of America's foremost economists, Professor Darren Acemoglu of MIT, who only last month shared the Nobel Prize for Economics.
I don't actually believe so. I don't believe there is anything in his program that is really targeted at helping those communities. Reduced trade with China, which his tariff policy would lead to, if implemented, wouldn't have a big impact on these communities. It would perhaps reduce the decline of some communities that may be the next one to be impacted by China, but it doesn't seem likely, and the previous Trump policies haven't really improved a lot of the people he said he was going to help. There isn't anything in his power about inflation. Inflation is coming down thanks to the central bank, to the Federal Reserve, and other conjectural factors such as reduced oil and food prices. And his overall agenda of deregulation, cutting taxes for businesses, getting rid of regulations on AI and cryptocurrency, I don't think those are going to have any relevance. In fact, I worry that they will have some medium-term effects that are not so positive for these communities.
I mean, he's also talked about cutting taxes for middle-class families. I mean, is it possible that those are going to make people feel better off in the coming years?
Well, of course, if we were to cut taxes for the middle class, in the short run, they would be better off. They would have greater purchasing power. But the question is, who's going to pay for the budget deficit that's going to result out of that? Either that means a huge debt burden, which it would again be the middle class that pays for that debt burden, or he has to really walk away from his agenda of cutting the taxes for the wealthy and the businesses.
He's also talked about more drilling for oil and gas. Could that help bring down prices further? And as you say, inflation has been cooling recently.
Yeah, inflation has been cooling. Energy prices are not the problem right now. Certainly, if you increase investment in drilling and oil extraction in some local economies, that's going to help the local economies. And I think that was one problem of the climate policies that other politicians have advocated, which is they did not explain clearly how they're going to help the communities that previously specialize in oil, coal, or other energy sectors. But obviously, nor is it the case that we can deal with the climate crisis when we say we're just going to drill more and not worry about climate change.
Can I ask you a bit more about his plan to impose tariffs or taxes? I mean, that message essentially of protectionism, saying that he wants to protect American jobs and American industries, I mean, that really struck a chord with people, didn't it?
There is no doubt in my mind that Trump has broken new ground in speaking to the American working class. But he hasn't broken new ground in finding policies, let alone implement policies, that would really help the American middle class. And by the way, there are smarter versions of protectionism that were implemented by the Biden administration. the Biden administration, people like Jake Sullivan, articulated a much more security-conscious and worker-centered trade policy for several years, but they're not across the board, like Trump is saying.
We're always told that certainty is what business is like. I mean, is the fact that he's going to be able to get things done, is that going to be good for investment and good for business?
It could be, but let me say, the huge elephant in the room is what we are not talking about. You know, my own focus throughout my career has been on institutional factors affecting medium-term economic growth. And I think there is general consensus among people who are objective that Trump is going to erode democratic norms. He's going to weaken democratic checks. He may politicize the Department of Justice. He's going to use his executive power in uncertain ways, perhaps providing help to companies and people he likes and going against those he deems as his enemies. But if we survive as a democracy but have serious damage to U.S. institutions, that's going to have important implications for the economy. It's going to create greater uncertainty, less trust in institutions, especially the judicial institutions, to arbitrate disputes between businesses. And it's going to really be damaging to complex industries such as AI and other sectors that require a lot of innovation. You make big investments in a new technology because you hope you're going to reap the benefits in 10 years or so, even more. So that's going to become much less likely. And that's a complete change in the U.S. institutional and U.S. economic fabric.
Just finally, I suppose the acid test will be whether people feel better off by 2029 at the end of his term. What's your prediction? Are they going to be better off or worse off?
I don't think they're going to be that much better off. The big costs of the Trump agenda may be later. For example, deregulation in AI and cryptocurrency is going to create a lot of problems, but we may not feel them until 2029. The erosion of the democratic fabric of society may have longer-term consequences. A lot of economists will tell you the Biden presidency was quite successful economically. Inflation came down from a pretty high level. Unemployment is as low as it's been for the last 30 years. The economy is growing, creating jobs. There's a lot of dynamism in certain sectors. If you actually look at the data, you'll see that wages at the bottom of the distribution, those who have been hurt most since 1980, have had a pretty good time under Biden. But those are also the people who say, we've been really harmed by inflation, and that has really colored the way they think about things. Now, inflation is coming down. It's already low. It's going to get lower. So will Trump get the credit for that? That's hard to know.
And that was Professor Darren Acemoglu of MIT, the winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Economics. On the next edition of NewsHour, we will be talking to a proponent of Donald Trump's economic policies, his former Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross. Coming up on this edition of the programme, Australia has said it'll ban children under the age of 16 from using social media. But will it work?
Many other places have tried this, but they've not been terribly successful, partly because of the challenges of technology and identifying age, but also because there are a number of different workarounds that people can actually use.
More on that in the next 30 minutes. Our main headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. The Ukrainian president has stressed the importance of close transatlantic ties following the re-election of Donald Trump. We'll be hearing more about that in about 15 minutes. There have been clashes in Mozambique in the latest protests against last month's vote. And opposition parties in Germany call for a swift vote of confidence in Olaf Scholz, now minority administration. More details on that coming up very shortly. This is James Menendez with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Well, governments across Europe are also trying to work out what Donald Trump's victory means for them, and in particular America's support for Ukraine as it tries to fend off Russia's military assault. They're holding a summit in Hungary today. We'll be finding out about that in the second half of the programme. But Europe's resolve towards Ukraine has also been tested by a political crisis in the continent's powerhouse, Germany. The coalition government there, between Social Democrats, Greens and the Liberal Free Democrats, has collapsed because of a budget row. And now opposition parties are demanding snap elections next month. Christian Lindner is the former finance minister who was part of that coalition.
Our country needs a government that not only holds office, but can act. The right thing for our country would be an immediate vote of confidence and new elections. No one in a democracy should be afraid of the voters. Quick new elections after the failed Scholz government are not only important for democracy, our country must not waste any time. Citizens must now have the opportunity to make decisions about the direction of their future themselves.
Well, let's speak to Nina Hasa-Trobridge, who's chief political correspondent with the German broadcaster Deutsche Welle. She's on the line now. Welcome to NewsHour. Christian Lindner, who we heard from there, I mean, he's at the heart of all this. Just remind us, why was he fired? Why did the coalition fall apart?
Well, to political observers like me, this didn't come as a complete surprise, to be honest. There had been so much infighting. There had been so many accusations going in all directions. And the bottom line was always that Christian Lindner had very different ideas of how to run an economy when you compare that to the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz from the Social Democrats and the Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck from the Greens, who's the economy minister. So these three men essentially battled it out on the open stage, and this was becoming unbearable. Olaf Scholz, when he did fire Christian Lindner last night on Wednesday, in his statement said that it was not just about these topics that they were in disagreement about whether to cut taxes or whether to invest more. It was also a question of a loss of trust. He became very, very personal. So this is something where it was clear that it had never been a marriage of love between those three coalition partners, but that now there have been too many incidents where Olaf Scholz felt that Christian Lindner had negotiated a compromise with the other two and then essentially not stuck to the rules. And what then broke it last night was that Christian Lindner essentially was asked to suspend the debt brake, that famous German debt brake, for a bit so that support for Ukraine can continue while Germany can also invest in its own future, in the economy, etc. And Christian Lindner refused.
So this will then have an impact on help for Ukraine, will it? Not least because I guess we've got several weeks of instability ahead.
Obviously, yes. We were going to see the parliament pass the budget for next year. Germany has a budget of some 450 billion euros, so it's a big, big budget. And Germany is, of course, still Europe's powerhouse. You said it. It's the world's third largest economy still. So we're talking about a lot of money. And if Parliament doesn't pass that budget, then, of course, no fresh money can flow. And what Olaf Scholz said, that he is going to go to Parliament in the first week of January and then call request a vote of confidence. And he doesn't suspect that he's going to win Parliament's approval, but German rules say that once the Chancellor has done that, then the German President can go ahead and dissolve Parliament within 21 days. So he has a bit of time to think about it. And then within 60 days, fresh elections have to be called. And so Olaf Scholz said last night that he is expecting fresh elections by March next year. Now, this is, of course, a very long time when you're thinking about how much Ukraine is struggling and all those big decisions that have been made where the money needs to flow now can't flow.
Yeah. Nina, thank you very much indeed for talking us through that. That was Nina Hasa-Trobridge, chief political correspondent at Deutsche Welle. Lebanon has long been criticised for its treatment of migrant workers. Now, since the outbreak of the war, many domestic workers from abroad have been left on the street by their sponsor families, who themselves have often had to flee their homes. And in many cases, the workers have been abandoned without their passports. Emir Nader reports now from Beirut.
We've just arrived at a huge warehouse in the centre of Beirut, next to one of the main motorways that cuts through the city. And inside there's one great room with around 200 women, all from Sierra Leone, some children. They were domestic workers who came to work in Lebanese families' homes. And since the war started, they've been either abandoned or they've had to flee.
I came in Lebanon 2022.
Surrounded by children playing and women chatting and reading their phones, we meet Aisha Karoma, 23 years old and still shaken by her close experience of the war.
They, in front of our house, they hit the bomb there. They leave me and run away because these people, they do not care about Me?
So they left you alone in the house?
Yes.
And they left Lebanon?
Yes. And just take their things and go.
When Israel began expanding its airstrike campaign on Lebanon at the end of September, many Lebanese families started fleeing the targeted neighborhoods, often leaving behind their domestic workers, like in Aisha's case, forcing them to sleep outdoors.
The very day in September the 26th, close to me, the bomb exploded.
Zainab Bangoura worked for a family in the south of Lebanon.
We decided to leave the area, to stay in the beach for 1 week, to sleep outside to save my life.
Most of the women at this shelter are stuck here. Under Lebanon's kafala system, families sponsor the residency of a migrant worker, but they regularly hold on to the workers' documents as a method of control. In many cases, when they fled the war, employers didn't return the passports, so women here are now trying to get new documents from their consulate. We're arriving to meet the representative of the syndicate of companies that brings migrant workers to work as domestic workers. Should the government be doing more to take care of women who say they've been abandoned in the street?
Suddenly, one day, people, Lebanese and foreigners, were in the street.
Here's Joseph Saliba.
So it was not well planned from us to be ready for such a huge something going on.
The families that have kicked their domestic workers out since the war started, that's a huge abandonment of their responsibility to the women who've been in their homes, no?
I can tell you that disaster that came from Israel is not only on the domestic helpers. Some families, they abandoned their brothers and sisters and mothers. The shock that came to the Lebanese people, in a 2 minutes' time, leave your house with nothing. You know, some of the houses they have left without their own documents. The gold of the money, they just run away.
Do you think the fact that there has to be these charities, like the shelter that's been set up for these hundreds of women who don't have anywhere to go, suggests that politicians or the sector here in Lebanon needs to do more to care for guests who are here in this country?
Financially, we are broken. We appreciate what our government is trying to do. We are asking it to do more. But at the end, this is Lebanon and this is what's going on.
It's not only some of Lebanon's 170,000 domestic workers who've been made homeless. Over 1 million people have been displaced by the conflict here. But it's domestic migrant workers in a foreign country at war who are among the most vulnerable.
That was Amir Nader reporting there from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Don't go away. Coming up on NewsHour in the next 30 minutes, our international editor Jeremy Bowen assesses the likely foreign policy of the second Trump term. Will the next administration reduce or stop aid altogether to Ukraine? It is the main issue at a summit of European leaders in Hungary today. We'll be hearing live from there. And Australia's plans to ban under-16s from using social media. How will it be enforced? All that's coming up after the news.
BBC News with Govinda Gill. President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that ties between Europe and the US should not be lost following the election of Donald Trump. The Ukrainian leader was joining a European security summit in Hungary, where future transatlantic relations are at the top of the agenda. Mr. Trump has been critical of NATO and the European Union. Police in Mozambique's capital, Maputo, have fired tear gas to try to stop opposition protests against the results of last month's disputed election. The country has seen weeks of unrest following the vote. Germany's main opposition party is calling for a vote of confidence next week over the collapse of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition government. The Christian Democrats say snap elections should be held in December. The Lebanese army says an Israeli strike near an army checkpoint at the southern city of Sidon has killed 3 people and wounded 3 soldiers and 4 UN peacekeepers. It gave their nationality as Malaysian. The Civil Defence Agency in Gaza says 12 people have been killed in an Israeli airstrike. It said a school housing displaced people in the Ashati refugee camp had been hit. AstraZeneca says another of its top China executives has been detained. The company said it would cooperate with the authorities who are investigating the pharmaceutical giant over a series of issues. Nepali rescuers have retrieved the body of a Slovak mountaineer who died a week ago after a trailblazing mountain ascent. Onjo Huseka fell into a crevasse while descending Langtang Lerang shortly after scaling the peak for the first time via its eastern flank. The online gaming platform Roblox is introducing new safety features for children. It follows complaints that some users have been exposed to upsetting content. That's the latest BBC News.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Let's head to the Middle East now, because this week an Israeli general, Itzik Cohen, said ground forces were now close to the, quote, complete evacuation of northern Gaza. He went on to say that residents will not be allowed to return home. Israel has always denied it wants to permanently control Gaza, encourage Palestinians to leave and to build Israeli settlements. Mahmoud Shalabi is Deputy Director of Programs for Medical Aid for Palestinians. He lived in Beit Lahia in the north of Gaza, but has had to leave. He's been talking to my colleague, Sarah Montague.
I have been displaced this time. If we count it, it's like the seventh time, just from the north of Gaza, from the city where I live, Beit Lahia, to Gaza City.
Now, the Israeli Defense Force has said that they are now close to the complete evacuation of northern Gaza. Is that your understanding?
I would say yes. Checking on my neighbors, unfortunately, none of them are there. And day by day, they are actually closing up on the areas where there are remaining people and forcing them to flee their homes. So they are either able to go to Gaza City or to other places in the north of Gaza. And they are very close to each other, those places. So the next day or the day after, they start a huge military operation in that location where the people have relocated to, and people start moving again and again and again. For me, as a citizen of the north of Gaza, I am really unsure whether I will be able to see my home again. I don't think so.
How would you feel if Israel effectively annexed the north of Gaza?
Devastated. I have been living in Beit Lahia for more than 25 years. I have so many memories in that place. My children, my three children, keep asking me, when are we going to return back home? And I really can't answer that question.
Of course, Donald Trump has now been elected as the next president. What difference do you think that will make for how Israel prosecutes this war?
I have no idea, but I don't think that Trump, Harris, or anyone from any government in the world is going to stop Israel. They have been breaking international humanitarian law in front of everyone. And the world has been silent and being, you know, accomplice to this genocide committed against Palestinians. It doesn't make much of a difference if it's Harris, Donald Trump, if it's the Labour Party in the UK or the Conservative Party. It's the same for me as a Palestinian.
You're in Gaza City now. Do you feel safe there, or do you think you're going to have to move again to further south?
If the annexation of the north happens, who would stop them from annexing Gaza City? If they are going to annex the north and they will annex Gaza City and we will be forced to the south, from the south, also another scenario could possibly happen for Palestinians being forced outside of the country.
Mahmoud Shalabi, who's Deputy Director of Programs for the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians. He was speaking to my colleague, Sarah Montague. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC World Service in London. I'm James Menendez with NewsHour. Donald Trump's imminent return to the White House has already raised expectations and concerns around the globe, from Ukraine to Israel and to China. But what does his first term in office tell us about the direction Mr. Trump's foreign policy could take when he takes office in January? Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has this assessment.
During his first term, Donald Trump's forays around the world often alarmed his allies. He seemed to have more respect for the authoritarian certainties of President Vladimir Putin of Russia and President Xi Jinping of China than he did for the grey shades of compromise in Western democracies. His overtures towards the world's strongmen could sound impulsive and naive. There was the time when he met Kim Jong-un, the hereditary ruler of North Korea.
And then we fell in love, okay? No, really. He wrote me beautiful letters.
Trump convinced himself that a pen pal relationship with Kim was a breakthrough for America, but Kim would not give up North Korea's nuclear weapons, and a full-blown summit in Vietnam in 2019 collapsed. In the 4 years since the chaos and violence at the end of the first Trump term, the world has become even more complicated and troubled. Sudan, the Middle East, and Ukraine are being devastated by war. Throughout the election campaign, Donald Trump insisted on his formula to end the Russia-Ukraine war.
I will have that war finished and done and settled before I get to the White House as president-elect. I will get that done.
He didn't say how he might do it. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine will be deeply worried that his country would pay the price for a deal, losing territory permanently to Russia. Ukraine couldn't fight on against Russia without American military aid. Zelensky will fear Joe Biden's arms supplies might be replaced with Trump's arm twisting. So on social media, Zelensky offered congratulations and appealed to Trump's self-image as a strong leader. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has also taught America's Western European allies a hard lesson that without American military power, they would struggle to defend themselves. A few days before the election, at a rally in Michigan, Trump went back to an old demand from his first term. His America would not offer anyone a free ride. He might go back to threatening to walk away from NATO itself. From the Middle East came congratulations from Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, praising what he called history's greatest comeback. He posted on X that your historic return to the White House offers a new beginning for America and a powerful recommitment to the great alliance between Israel and America. The Israelis needed a lot of American help to defend themselves against Iranian missiles, and they couldn't fight on multiple fronts without U.S. military and diplomatic support. President Biden would not use the leverage that gave him to insist on a ceasefire. Middle East watchers here in Washington believe Trump could impose an American agenda on Israel. Vali Nasser is a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
The Middle East is also on the edge of drawing America into another major war in the Middle East. And I don't think Donald Trump, based on his record, wants that. So it's not that he cares about Palestinians or cares about Lebanon or cares about Iran. He may very well not agree with the theory of the case that Bibi Netanyahu has, which is to expand the war and, if need be, draw the United States into it.
One more big challenge in the second Trump term will come from China. Since Trump left office, China has made bigger strides towards rivaling America as the world's strongest power. On the eve of the election, Trump repeated his plan to put a big tax on imports from China and others, which is also known as a trade war.
And I'm doing the same thing with China. We're going to tariff the hell out of them.
Longer term, a real war is another risk, with growing military tension between China and Taiwan. Before he leaves office, Donald Trump might have to decide whether America will fight to defend an island 7,000 miles away across the Pacific that is only 100 miles from the Chinese mainland.
That was our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Well, as I mentioned earlier, European leaders are meeting in the Hungarian capital, Budapest, today. It's a summit of the European political community, which brings together 42 heads of state and government, so much broader than the EU. It was originally convened in response to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Well, there are those concerns that Donald Trump might decide to reduce American support for Ukraine. The NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says Europe needs to work with the incoming president.
The people of the United States have now elected him. He is the president. I worked very well with him for 4 years. He is extremely clear about what he wants. He understands that you have to deal with each other to come to joint positions, and I think we can do that.
Live to Budapest to talk to the BBC's Nick Thorpe. And Nick, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is there. He's been addressing those leaders today. What did he have to say?
Well, James, yeah, he is here. He was pretty short of words, really, in his comments, both on the Trump victory so far and today. We didn't actually get a full script yet of his comments here, but certainly his presence here alongside, apart from, as you said, the EU leaders, Keir Starmer is here, President Erdogan of Turkey is here, Mark Rutte, as you mentioned, is here from NATO, the leader of Moldova, West Balkan leaders. So it's a sort of talking shop, and Zelensky, like other leaders, is trying to put a sort of a positive spin on the election of Donald Trump, looking for positives out of it, because this is an astonishing opportunity, really, for European leaders to take stock of what's just happened in America.
And is the thinking, I mean, it's early days, but is the thinking amongst European leaders that actually they will or may have to look after their own security, particularly when it comes to Ukraine going forward?
I think it is. Well, certainly more so than until now. President Macron of France speaking about the need for Europe to take responsibility for its own security now. The same message, interestingly, from the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, the host of this meeting, talking, you know, normally he criticizes the rest of the EU as sort of leaders who've dragged Europe into a hopeless war and phrases like that. Today, speaking very differently, much more in a friendly tone, talking about exactly collective security, how Europe can take more responsibility. And of course, NATO countries have increased their defense budget out of sort of in sort of response to President Trump's you know, appeals to them to do more of that. So a very interesting moment and a lot to talk about here in Budapest among all these leaders.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Nick Thorpe there. To Australia now, because the government there says it's going to put forward new laws in Parliament to ban children under the age of 16 from social media. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said it was time to take action for the mums and dads, as he put it, who are worried sick about their kids' safety online. Well, this was the reaction from three young people in Australia.
But I don't think all social media is bad. I just think it should be very heavily limited.
Well, it's just like really easy to bully people on social media.
I don't know if it should be banned, but I think there should be more restrictions.
How, though, would such a ban work in practice? Lisa Given is Professor of Information Sciences at RMIT University in Melbourne.
I think that's exactly where the devil lies. I think the challenge here is both a social one and a technical one. In the short run, they've got to find a way, tech companies, of how do we actually verify people's ages? This is something that would affect all Australians, not just youth, but every single person is effectively going to have to demonstrate they're over the age of 16. And so it could be a real challenge just in terms of ensuring that the types of people they're trying to keep offline are indeed able to be kept offline.
Does the technology exist to verify people's ages? I mean, how might it work?
There are some technologies. So, for example, even now, if you attempt to buy a bottle of wine online here in Australia, there's a system called Age Assurance, where you basically say, yes, I'm over the age of 18, I can purchase that bottle of wine. That's obviously something that is very loose. People could lie about their age, for example. So if a tech company is being held to a certain standard, they're really going to have to ask for legal identity. They're going to have to ask for government ID, for example. There are other technologies that are being trialed currently, which even look at people's patterns of behavior on social media. So what kinds of accounts do they follow, as well as facial recognition? But much of that is really still in its infancy.
I mean, what's the experience of other countries? Has anyone else tried to do this and have they had any success?
Many other places have tried this. For example, Texas in the United States tried to implement a ban of anyone under the age of 18. France has tried under the age of 14, but they've not been terribly successful, partly because of the challenges of technology and identifying age, but also because there are a number of different workarounds that people can actually use, such as VPN access or just accessing content on other people's accounts.
Yes, and children are often better at doing that than their parents, aren't they? Because they understand the technology better. You mentioned at the beginning that there was a social component to this. I suppose some people might say, you know, isn't it up to parents to try and police what goes on under their own roofs?
Absolutely. I think parents have a critical role here, particularly around helping children to navigate these challenging spaces. We need our kids to actually learn those critical thinking skills, critical assessment of technology, and sometimes the parents themselves need a lot of education in order to navigate these platforms.
And I wonder whether the effect of a law like this, I mean, despite the difficulties that we've talked about, is that it sort of sets the tone of what society, in this case Australian society, deems to be acceptable.
Absolutely, it does. The challenge is this really the solution that we need? What this legislation does is effectively impose a one-size-fits-all ban. So it treats every young person as though they're of equal standing in terms of their maturity, their ability to navigate these spaces. And it can also introduce a number of other potential challenges in terms of privacy concerns. If, for example, we're asked to upload personal identifying information to tech company platforms.
That was Lisa Given, who's Professor of Information Sciences at RMIT University in Melbourne. A reminder that if you want to listen to NewsHour but miss our live broadcast or any part of it, you can always get a podcast of the programme. It's updated twice a day. Just search for BBC NewsHour podcast. You'll find it there. And of course, you can subscribe to the feed and then it will download automatically on a regular basis. And it is, of course, completely free. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Still more to come on this edition of the programme. This is James Menendez with NewsHour Live from the BBC. A day on from Kamala Harris's defeat, the knives are out for Joe Biden. He shouldn't have run, said Jim Manley, a top aide to congressional Democrats. This is no time to pull punches or be concerned about anyone's feelings. He and his staff have done an enormous amount of damage to this country, he went on. Well, as for her, the party is split, and those who see Kamala Harris as their champion are still loyal to her. Justin Webb reports.
I thank you all. May God bless you. And may God bless
you. We've come to Howard University, not far from the center of Washington, D.C., the historically black university, which was one of the intellectual powerhouses of the civil rights movement, and which numbers among its former students Kamala Harris, the vice president. They so hoped she would be president as well. And the mood on election night here was ecstatic.
I'm feeling so patriotic on this night. I cannot wait for Kamala Harris to be president. So I just feel really good to be here, and I cannot wait to be a part of history.
How will you feel if she doesn't win?
I don't think that's an option at this point. I feel like she's going to win. She's going to pull through.
And then the votes were counted, and the mood changed, and the mood is very different. I've been asking people who's to blame and what should happen next.
I don't think anything went wrong from the Harris campaign. I think she did everything she was supposed to do. She couldn't do anything else. I think it's just a sign of the America we live in, that we've always lived in, and the truth is now just slapping us in the face.
And when you say the truth being what?
You know what the truth is. We all know what the truth is. So
come on, tell me.
No, you know, sexism and racism. You can never take away, this moment doesn't take away what one woman from Oakland, California accomplished. She was the vice president of the United States, period.
Guys, we're from the BBC. Have you got just a second? We're asking people what, in their view, went wrong with the campaign, if anything. Where did she go wrong? Where did the party go wrong?
I don't think she did anything wrong. I think America just doesn't like black women. That's really long and short of it.
I feel like it's very disappointing. I feel like there was a lot of optimism at the beginning, and then seeing that she was behind from the jump and never really caught up, I think that was kind of sad to see. But I feel like when she runs again and she has the same amount of time and has more time to actually get her campaign going, I think she has a better result.
That's interesting. You think she should run again in 4 years' time?
Of course. Of course, yeah. I think so.
A simple question, I suppose. What went wrong?
We were confident in the ground game because Democrats have to do that. It's a necessity to organize underrepresented communities, working class people. At least that's who we thought our base was. Turns out we were wrong. We missed the mark. I think there's a need to do a lot of soul searching about who our base is, how we speak to our base, reconnect with our working class roots, and ask ourselves why are people who were making under a certain income threshold turning to him? Is it because they're anti-establishment more than they are pro-Trump? Is it because we've left them? The party is now more elitist and college-educated and aligned with corporate donors.
How do you deal with that? What do you do now?
I don't think the wage should be on Kamala Harris. I think this is a multi-decade problem that the party has. We've seen it with insurgent candidates like Bernie Sanders trying to buck up against the corporate class and the establishment wing of the party that is too connected to their donors. What do we do now? I think we have to take a step back. You know, it wasn't enough, in my opinion. Trump capitalized on that.
So what's next for the Democrats? Let's speak to the Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters from California's 43rd District. Welcome to NewsHour. Where did it go wrong?
Well, let me just say that Kamala Harris did a tremendous job in a short period of time. As a woman and a black, this was a first for the United States of America. And not only was it a short period of time, it was a moment in history where we had the major number of people who were white, who were not supported in sufficient numbers of a woman and a black woman. And so when you combine that with the Latin community, who is wishing and thinking that they're assimilating, ended up giving Trump the majority votes. And so it's not that she did anything wrong. It is that America did something wrong.
Did Joe Biden do something wrong? As Jim Manley said, that he shouldn't have run and he should have given whoever was the candidate more time, and that there should have been a proper primary.
Well, I don't think it's proper to talk about he did something wrong. This man had appointed a black woman to the Supreme Court. He had chosen a black woman for the vice presidency. He had done a great job in, when he did step down, and supporting her and endorsing her. He's going down in history as having done the most things to move forward the possibility of inclusion of black people at the highest level. So it's not that he did something wrong. It's that the majority of whites in this country did not support Kamala Harris.
Congresswoman, we don't know the outcome of or what the House is going to look like and who's going to have a majority yet. If the Republicans do control the House, are you prepared to work with them?
I'm prepared to fight as hard as I possibly can against exclusion, against racism, against the corporate world running and controlling the Congress of the United States of America. I'm prepared to fight for justice and equality and for the least of these. And so my fight continues. It is not that I think that somehow the Republicans are going to wake up and decide they're going to work with us. You have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others who said the Constitution should be gotten rid of. You have a president elect now who is a liar, a divider, and who has basically used his power to align himself with Putin in Russia. There's no patriotism left in him. And so when you talk about, are you prepared to work with the other side? Are they prepared to change? Okay. Are they prepared to do what is in the best interest of all of the country?
Congresswoman, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. But thank you very much indeed for joining us today. That was the Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters. And that is the end of this edition of NewsHour from me and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next time. Bye-bye.